Postcard from East Africa, published on Thursday, the 22nd of August, 2024. In mid-August, I spent a week in East Africa, visiting four cities in three countries. The trip started in Nairobi, Kenya's capital and the region's largest, most affluent city. The next stop was Kigali, the capital of Rwanda, a country that many will associate with the genocide of 1994, but is now one of the most prosperous in the region, and is even referred to as the Switzerland of Africa. The trip continued in Kampala, the capital of Uganda, a country benefiting from a strong tailwind thanks to the discovery of oil in western Uganda. The final stop was Mombasa, the port city in Kenya through which much of East African trade flows. Over the week, I endeavoured to speak with as many and as diverse range of people as possible. On the first day in Nairobi, I held a talk in the morning at the local Entrepreneurs Organization, or EO, where I met the owners of several of Kenya's largest privately owned businesses. One member, Nimit, gave me a tour of a shopping mall he is building. See image. In the afternoon, I visited Kibera, Kenya's largest slum and home to an estimated population of 1 million people. See image. There, I met with a community leader, local entrepreneurs, and a young man who had just won a green card in the US. That day, I travelled, both literally and figuratively, from one end of the economic spectrum to the other. The focus of the trip was investing, so most days were filled with meetings. I met with around 10 companies, including telcos such as Safaricom, MTN and Airtel, banks such as KCB, I&M and Stanbic, a brewer called East African Breweries, the Nairobi Securities Exchange, and ESL, a privately owned logistics company in Mombasa. In addition, I met with DEG, a German Development Finance Institution, or DFI for short, and several local investors. Aside from the formal meetings, I had many enjoyable conversations with the people in the service industry one inevitably encounters on such a trip. That the schedule was so rich was thanks largely to the efforts of Francis Wangi from Kestrel Capital. See image. He both organized my trip and accompanied me for most of it. My sincerest thanks go to him, Ephantus, Millicent, and the rest of the team. I am trying to encourage Francis to come to the annual gathering in Engelberg. If you are planning to attend and are interested in East Africa, please send him an email stating how much you are looking forward to meet him to learn more about investing in Africa. Some background on East Africa. In the unlikely event that you knew as little about the region as I did before the trip, here is some background. There are different definitions of East Africa, but the core is generally considered to be Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, and Rwanda. The East African Community, or EAC, has 8 partner states, the others being Burundi, the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC for short, Somalia, and South Sudan. The region ranges from Somalia in the north to Tanzania in the south. See image. The EAC is home to an estimated 302 million citizens, of which over 30% is urban population. It has a land area of 5.4 million square kilometers and a combined gross domestic product of $313 billion. East Africa is acknowledged as the cradle of early modern humans who first emerged 200 to 300,000 years ago. If you are listening to this from outside of East Africa, you have migrant ancestors. A new pandemic? This postcard's purpose is to communicate what I learned on the trip and, where appropriate, add my thoughts. One caveat though. I realize there is a dangerous epidemic of fund managers pontificating on matters that they know just about enough to be dangerous. My daughters call this mansplaining. My aim with this postcard is not to accelerate the spread of this dangerous virus, but simply to convey what I learned from spending a week in the region and speaking with tens, if not hundreds, of locals. There are, no doubt, many misunderstandings and omissions in what follows. I hope there is nevertheless value in the perspective of a well-intentioned outsider. I console myself with the thought that the locals generally find more entertainment value in what visitors misunderstand about their country than what they get right. What a difference a week makes. Without wishing to qualify the above, it amazes me how much you can learn in a week simply by formulating pertinent questions, speaking with as many people as possible, and seeing where the same answer consistently turns up.
At the risk of repeating myself, there are for sure plenty of topics that I've either misunderstood or overlooked completely. This postcard has no ambitions to be definitive. I believe, though, that we would all understand each other a little better if people undertook more trips like this one. Safe and livable cities. One of the earliest realizations was how safe and livable the major cities in East Africa are. Like perhaps many Westerners, I felt a sense of trepidation before flying there and inquired about the security situation given the recent protests in Nairobi. I need not have. The people I encountered were generally softly spoken, kind, and hospitable. Like everywhere, it is best to avoid the wrong neighborhoods or being out after dark, but generally, I felt comfortable moving around, including in Kibera. Nairobi is the most livable city in the region. Nearly everyone speaks first-class English. It has a temperate climate, traffic flows freely most of the time thanks to new road construction, credit cards are widely accepted, Uber works, and it has some great restaurants. Cultiva and Bait and Salem were my favourites. Thank you, Ella, for the recommendations. Crucially, at least from my perspective, it has plenty of good coffee shops. See image taken at Spring Valley Coffee in Lavington. The city has a modern character. As you speed along the expressway linking Nairobi Airport to downtown on a modern, elevated highway lined with high-rise buildings, you get the vibes of an Asian mecca city. See image. The city is a magnet for multinationals and, in particular, aid organizations. Nairobi is one of the UN's four global headquarters, and its headcount will grow to over 10,000 people in the coming years as staff are relocated there from New York. They are attracted by the international schools, good healthcare, and the other expats, in addition to all the characteristics mentioned above. Postings to other cities in the region are less sought after, which is a pity as they would benefit from having more expats there. The most modern city in the region is Kigali, the capital of Rwanda. I stayed at the Radisson Blue Hotel. It is part of a large complex that includes one of the largest and most modern convention centres in the region, the Kigali Convention Centre. See image. A long, perfectly asphalted boulevard lined with palm trees and modern office buildings leads out of the convention centre into the city. A few days before my arrival, it had hosted many heads of African states who came to celebrate the re-election of Paul Kagame for a fifth term. The city has aspirations to be the main hub for logistics and commerce in the region. The convention centre has played a significant role in positioning Kigali as a hub for conferences, meetings and events in Africa. It is constructing a new international airport too. In terms of some of the softer factors that make a city desirable to live in, it is playing catch-up with Nairobi though. On the day I spent in Rwanda, I skipped lunch and visited the Kigali Genocide Memorial. The scale of the genocide was truly horrific. 1 million people died and 2 million were displaced, out of a population of 7 million. Much of the killing was carried out by former friends and neighbours, using machetes and clubs. It makes the country's progress all the more impressive since. From what I gather, the country has done a great job of reconciliation. However, across the border in the DRC, the fighting continues and contributes to the catastrophic security situation in the country. My stay in Rwanda also afforded me one of my fondest memories of the trip, being awoken at 6 a.m. by the rising sun and African singing. I couldn't figure out at the time exactly where the singing was coming from, but was later told that it was most likely an open-air religious ceremony. It also afforded me one of my saddest memories as well. When I ventured out of the city for a walk on Mount Kigali, I came across a group of women breaking rocks and their young children collecting them in bags. It served as a reminder not to over-index to experiences in the city. Kampala was the most backward city I visited during the trip. It had a modern expressway from the airport, but the roads entering the city were in a poor state and surrounded by slums. It is, however, the city which has the brightest outlook, thanks to the discovery of oil on the border to the DRC and the influx of foreign capital. The sense of optimism was palpable in all of my meetings. Size. Apart from a general curiosity about the world, the main inspiration to visit the African continent came from the late Hans Rosling and his book Factfulness. In it, he forecasts that the population of the African continent may increase from 1 billion today to 4 billion by the end of the century, depending on fertility rates. With the populations of Asia, the Americas, and Europe likely to remain comparatively stable, the continent is likely to be an important driver of economic growth over the next century. Irrespective of whether I end up investing there, I figured it makes sense to better understand what is happening there. If the initial catalyst to travel to Africa was that it would one day be a huge market, a sobering realization is that that day is some way off. Kenya, the largest country in the region, has a population of just 52 million. This would make it a middling country if GDP per capita were comparable to Western levels, but it is, of course, a fraction of that. It has a GDP of $104 billion, according to the IMF, making it the 68th largest economy in the world, sandwiched between Venezuela and Bulgaria. Fragmentation. Unfortunately, the region is relatively fragmented too, so it does not benefit from the economies of scale that would be available if the individual countries were more tightly integrated. Transport links are poor. A Kenyan I met in Kigali told me it takes him 24 hours to get home by bus, including a 30-minute wait at the Ugandan border and a 60-minute wait at the Kenyan border. I heard from others that the fastest way to fly between some African countries is via Europe. Things are improving though. I saw many new expressways in the countries I visited and still more that are in planning. See image. Kigali is building a new international airport, and Ugandans hope that a high-speed rail link from the coast to Nairobi will be extended up to Kampala. This would improve my Kenyan friend's life considerably. The visa situation has improved for locals. East Africans can travel visa-free to neighboring countries. However, visitors such as myself need a separate visa for each country. I mistakenly thought I could apply for a visa on arrival in Uganda and was initially refused boarding on my flight there. Fortunately, though, the immigration authorities in Kampala agreed to make an exception. Had I been refused entry, though, it would have been an own goal for the country. Rwanda does have visa on arrival, a reflection of its efforts to encourage business and tourism in the country. I met with Rwanda Finance, a private company mandated to promote and develop Rwanda, and was impressed by their vision for the country. As it is the Switzerland of Africa, though, I may be biased. Undeveloped stock markets. If the economies are small, the stock markets are even smaller. The Nairobi Securities Exchange is the largest in the region, but has just 64 listed stocks, many of which are part-owned by the government. Trading volume for the total market is around $1 million per day. The other stock exchanges are significantly smaller. Uganda has 18 listed companies, and Rwanda has 10. Disappointingly, the Nairobi Stock Exchange has not had an IPO since 2011, 13 years ago. A dearth of IPOs. I asked nearly everyone I met on the trip why more companies do not seek a stock market listing. Some of the answers I received were that bonds are more attractive. Kenyan government bonds yield 18% at the time of writing. Private equity players can pay more, thanks to financing by DFIs motivated by less than market-based returns. And entrepreneurs prefer to avoid the public exposure that a listing brings, to avoid the prying eyes of politicians and, perhaps equally importantly, relatives. I met with the CEO of the NSE, see image, and was surprised to learn that encouraging new listings was not one of the top three priorities he listed for his tenure. If the region wishes to attract public equity investors like me to its stock markets, there is considerable work to do, both to encourage more companies to list and to improve liquidity. After the trip, I connected him with Interactive Brokers, so I hope to have made a small contribution in this respect. Corruption. Perhaps one of the biggest concerns amongst Westerners about investing in Africa is the prevalence of corruption. I would love to report back that the problem is overestimated or that things are improving. Instead, I came back with a greater appreciation of how big and how far-reaching the problem is. The image on the cover of this postcard was taken at the entrance to the Nairobi airport. There was a soldier standing near the sign, and I asked him if I was allowed to take the photo. Without any sense of irony, he told me I was not, but he would turn a blind eye if I gave him a tip. For the record, I didn't, but took the photo anyway. In Kenya, I heard estimates that one-third of the government's budget was stolen by politicians and compromised civil servants. I write was, as the consensus is that things have worsened considerably under the new government. It is bad enough that a third of taxpayers' money does not reach the intended recipients. However, what makes it so much worse is the impact of corruption on the broader economy, or what can be thought of as second-order effects. Here are a handful of anecdotes I heard that illustrate the point. The development of apartment buildings ground to a halt in one city I visited. The reason? The governor's family demanded one of the apartments, more often than not the penthouse, as a condition for granting a building permit. The upshot was that developers postponed new projects or simply built elsewhere. Beer consumption is shrinking, even though Kenya has a growing and youthful population. The reason is that excise duties are so high that the cost of a beer in a bar is as expensive as in Switzerland. As a result, consumers shift their consumption to white spirits, which currently have lower taxes per litre, and moonshine. Needless to say, the consumption of spirits and illicit alcohol is bad for Kenyans' health and for legitimate bar and restaurant owners. Businesses avoid getting too big as they are fearful of attracting the attention of local politicians and tax collectors. One entrepreneur told me that the expression used by locals to describe this phenomenon was getting too close to the sun. Large entrepreneurs gave a similar reason for not wanting to be on the stock exchange. How much larger would the Kenyan economy be if entrepreneurs were less fearful of getting too close to the sun? And it is increasingly difficult to assess the viability of large infrastructure projects without paying a bribe. I heard from larger entrepreneurs that the cost of meeting some politicians is now $250,000, and even then there is no guarantee you will get a clear answer. One bright spot, though, seems to be Rwanda. It seems sincere in its attempt to become a business hub and has made considerable progress in becoming more business friendly. For example, it is possible to set up a business there in less than one day. The Rwandan economy has enjoyed best-in-class economic growth of 7 to 8% over the last 10 years. I hope politicians in the rest of the region learn from its example. Freedom. What I heard about corruption, mainly in Kenya, was depressing. I do, though, see one positive takeaway that is not to be underestimated. Kenya is a relatively free society where people feel comfortable expressing their opinion, even if it is critical of the government. This is the case in private, as I experienced firsthand in many conversations, but it is also the case in public. Near the capital's parliament, I saw people speaking publicly against the government. It felt somewhat like Hyde Park's Speaker's Corner. And shortly before my visit, thousands of Kenyans mobilized in front of the capital's parliament to protest against an unpopular finance bill and government waste in general. When I travel to places like China, I hear much less about corruption. Is it because there is less corruption there, or because people are terrified about discussing it? Probably both. A further advantage that Kenya has over countries in the region is shorter terms for the president and governors. Since the new constitution was enacted in 2010, the president and governors are limited to 2 5-year terms. This serves as an important check on power. Both Rwanda and Uganda enjoy greater political stability today, with presidents that have been in power for 30 and 38 years respectively. What things will look like under their successors, though, is anybody's guess. A crossroads. Today, Kenya could be at a turning point. On the one hand, government corruption seems to be both accelerating and becoming more entrenched. In response to the demonstrations, the president fired his existing cabinet, perhaps a good sign. However, he invited opposition politicians to take up government posts, likely a bad sign as it removes any remaining semblance of political plurality. On the other hand, the country's youth are politically engaged and, thanks to the ubiquity of mobile phones, better connected. They want change, and as the demonstrations show, they are willing and able to demand it. It will be fascinating to follow how this plays out in the coming years. Chinese money. A major topic both within East Africa and beyond is the increasing presence of Chinese money. When you travel in the region, you see it everywhere. I saw the expressways linking both Nairobi Airport and Kampala Airport to their downtowns, the high-speed railway line linking Nairobi to Mombasa, and the new container port in Mombasa. All were built by the Chinese. China is also playing a central role in the development of Uganda's nascent oil industry, both in terms of production in the Rift Valley and the construction of a new pipeline to the coast at Dar es Salaam. I asked people what they made of this. Western DFIs made no effort to hide their contempt. They argued that the projects create little value locally as they are carried out by Chinese workers and even use raw materials imported from China. Their terms are not made public, which invites corruption and potentially leaves future generations of Kenyans with unserviceable debts if the terms are too onerous. The quality is shoddy, and some of the workers may be convicts. The views of the locals I spoke with were more nuanced. They disagreed that the projects did not create value, pointing out how the new roads have improved their lives, irrespective of who built them. And in Uganda, they also pointed out that the amount of local content has increased over time, partly as it is mandated by the government, and partly because Ugandans have become more highly skilled. They told me it is now rare to see a Chinese person at a road construction site other than the site manager supervising the work. They were not overly concerned about corruption either, as they were resigned to the fact that the politicians would figure out a way to get their slice of the pie one way or another. By far their biggest concern was the opacity of the contracts and the risk that they burden future generations of Africans with unserviceable debt. China would do a service to itself and the world if it were more transparent on the terms of its projects. As one person put it, they get shit done. A legitimate question is at what price? Western money. Western money is not without its shortcomings either. As far as I can judge, it is far less effective. In 2019, a French consortium signed an agreement with the Kenyan government to build an expressway linking Mombasa to Nairobi. The effort went nowhere. Earlier this year, the project was taken up by the US. I hope for Kenyans that the US fares better than the French did. A further shortcoming is that Western money is increasingly driven by ideology rather than the needs of East Africans. Europe makes compliance with its environmental, social and governance policies, or ESG for short, a precondition for sending its money. As with elsewhere in the world, it is exporting its regulation. As one private equity manager put it, money is the carrot and regulation is the stick. Regulation slows projects down due to mountains of paperwork, but more importantly, it prevents projects being financed that are most likely to improve the lives of ordinary Africans. For example, DEG does not support oil production and effectively cannot invest in heavy industries such as steel or cement, as it is inconsistent with its mission to reduce the carbon footprint. From an environmental perspective, this perhaps makes sense. But from the perspective of a region that is dependent on oil imports, I didn't see a single electric car on the entire trip, and is still lacking in basic infrastructure, it certainly does not. It is ironic that Western DFIs criticize the Chinese for importing raw materials, but do not provide the locals with the means to produce locally. To their credit, the local DEG team acknowledged this. USAID is increasingly ideological too, but its goal is to counter China's influence in the region. To this end, US DFIs have been granted large budget increases by Congress. The increase in aid is welcomed by the locals, but one of the fears I heard is that it could worsen the region's corruption problem, as budgets have increased at a faster rate than the capacity to oversee them. The DEG told me it would be impossible to deploy so much capital whilst applying European governance standards. I will leave it to you, dear reader, to make up your own mind whether this reflects more poorly on the EU or the US. An influx of foreign aid and aid workers. What is clear is that the region in general, and Nairobi in particular, will see a huge influx of foreign aid and aid workers. The UN is massively increasing its presence, and other organizations will follow. Locals are excited about the construction and high-spending expats this will bring. My feelings are more mixed. I am not a market absolutist and acknowledge that markets sometimes fail. The people who most need insurance sometimes cannot get it, and rural areas that would benefit most from transport links are sometimes passed by. Government and foreign aid can and should fill these gaps. However, I strongly believe that the region would greatly benefit from more private enterprise, not less. When an aid program works, it makes headlines. When a company defrauds its customers, it also makes headlines. This does not show that all aid workers are good and all business people are bad. It shows that an aid program that works is roughly as newsworthy as a company that does not. I heard about the unintended consequences of foreign aid when meeting some local private equity funds. Their funds are effectively uninvestable for new investors as they are filled with investments that are overvalued. The DFIs sponsoring these funds do not want to realize the losses on these investments and instead roll them over into new funds at inflated values. I heard of one transaction where a stake in a Kenyan bank was rolled into a new fund at book value, even though the listed entity trades at a fraction of that. The situation may spare the DFI's blushes in the short term, but it hinders the development of a thriving private equity market in the long term. I felt sorry for some of the local investors I met who, like me, dream of building an investment company with market-beating returns, but instead have to settle for mediocre returns and filling out endless ESG questionnaires to keep their LPs sweet. Foreign aid has its benefits. It is difficult to imagine that there would be as much investment in infrastructure without DFIs. And the UK DFI played an important role in funding the research that led to M-Pesa, an innovative mobile banking service I discuss later in this postcard. However, FDIs need a greater appreciation of trade-offs, where they can best help, and when they need to get out of the way. Entrepreneurship. Kenyans are highly entrepreneurial. Nobody should worry about their ability to make money if the government simply gets out of their way. I saw many examples of this. An EO member told me that nearly every Kenyan has a side hustle. His caddy owns two hair salons. In Nairobi, the space between the highway and the pavement is planted with assorted flora that street vendors sell to passers-by. Apart from providing some people with a livelihood, it beautifies the roads. See image. I had a particularly interesting dinner with two Kenyan small business owners. One has managed to build a highly lucrative online publishing business in the US, based out of a village 2 hours' drive from Nairobi. His brother is no slouch either. He has built an IT security business with 15 employees. They were the ones that told me about the dangers of getting too close to the sun. Kenyans speak first-class English. With all due respect to my Indian friends, it is far better than theirs. It may even be better than the Anglo-Saxons. I heard there is an underground industry of Kenyans completing homework assignments for Western school kids. I will be closely monitoring my children's phone bills going forward. It is a mystery to me why this has not led to a boom in outsourcing to Kenya comparable to the one seen in India. I asked several people about this on the trip but did not get a satisfactory answer. There are efforts to change this though. M-Pesa. Entrepreneurship and innovation are not limited to small businesses. The most impressive company that I saw on the trip, and likely the company that has done the most to improve the lives of ordinary Kenyans, is Safaricom. Safaricom is the leading mobile network company in Kenya with a 67% market share. Its major innovation, though, is M-Pesa. M stands for mobile and Pesa is money in Swahili. It is a groundbreaking mobile money service that has transformed financial transactions in Kenya and several neighboring countries that have followed Safaricom's lead. The way it works is that M-Pesa users can deposit or withdraw funds using Safaricom's network of over 100,000 agents, typically small retail outlets. Once funds are in their mobile wallet, they can transfer money, pay bills, borrow, and increasingly make use of many other financial services. All this can be done through USSD, a communication protocol used by mobile networks to send text messages between a mobile phone and an application program in the network. All that is required is a feature phone. M-Pesa was launched in 2007. The idea originated from a research project funded by the UK DFI, which aimed to explore how mobile phones could facilitate microfinance loan payments in Kenya. The impact of M-Pesa on the Kenyan economy is enormous. It is estimated that 60% of Kenya's GDP goes through M-Pesa, making it part of Kenya's critical infrastructure. I got a sense of this when accessing the building, as the security checks were by far the most thorough of any company I visited. When M-Pesa goes down, the Kenyan economy grinds to a halt. M-Pesa has also brought banking services to ordinary Kenyans. It is a major driver of financial inclusion. M-Pesa is a great example of entrepreneurship, innovation, and how FDIs can help. Demographics. The final point that the region has in its favor is its demographics. All the countries I visited have very young populations. 41% of Kenya's population is under the age of 18, and in Uganda it is as high as 48%. I got a sense of the youthfulness of the Kenyan population at the Kibera slum. I saw hundreds of children happily running around and playing outside a church whilst their parents attended a wedding service inside. They were excited to see me, or more precisely my Apple Watch, and started pressing it to make it light up. After I left, I noticed that they had activated the workout function. After a week of good food and even better company, I wish I had been as diligent as they were in starting the workout app. Final thoughts. I cannot say whether the trip has left me more or less optimistic about East Africa, as I did not know enough about the region beforehand to have a view. What it has given me is a greater appreciation of the challenges that the region faces. Corruption, size, fragmented markets, overbearing government, and foreign aid, as well as the opportunities, a youthful, and at least in Kenya, politically engaged population, thriving cities, increasing investment, a spirit of entrepreneurship, and yes, foreign aid. It seems unlikely that we will invest there in the short term, if for no other reason than there is insufficient liquidity on the region's stock exchanges. That does not bother me at all, though. I viewed the trip as an opportunity to learn about a region I knew too little about beforehand, and in that respect, it was a resounding success. I suspect the trip will also be beneficial from an investing perspective in the longer term. It has left me with a set of assumptions about the region which I can test against the actual development in the years to come. It gave me a better understanding of East Africa and its role in the continent and the wider world. And it has provided me with a network of contacts that can be drawn upon to evaluate future investments, either in Africa or in companies impacted by what happens in Africa. For the world to succeed, it needs Africa to succeed. I hope we can be part of that success one day. Thanks for listening, and happy investing.